Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. We hope you love the show and you love it so much that you'll want more info. Well, you can always find more info on everything you hear at splendidtable.org. Recipes, videos, more information on all of our guests and their books, and you can subscribe to our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about delicious things to make on weeknights. But right now, let's get to this week's show, hosted by Lynn Rosetto Casper.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. Right now, the farm-to-table restaurant is the biggest of the latest big things. Yet, I have to wonder how many of those farms that send food to those tables are in places like Venezuela. The ideals behind farm-to-table of buying local, supporting sustainable agriculture, and offering fair pay often don't end up in a profitable business, especially if your restaurant's in a place where the growing season is an afterthought. Well, Minnesota chef Lenny Russo is a member of an exclusive club. That is, a handful of North Country chefs who figured out how the idealistic methods of farm-to-table can work with their bottom line. Then again, I think he's been up to his ears in local agricultural issues since 1985 when he stepped off the plane from Florida. Now, in the spirit of full disclosure, I should add that Lenny's a longtime friend, and I've written the foreword to his book, Heartland, Farm Forward Dishes from the Great Midwest. Hey, Lenny, it's good to have you with us.
I'm so happy to be here. It's just so great to see you.
I want to know about the realities that a chef faces when you're talking farm to table.
Well, it really depends on how farm to table you are, so to speak. The reality is that we use just local product, and given how northern we are, winter poses a significant challenge. Another challenge is to make sure that you're using everything the farmer provides you. So we're buying whole animals and using everything.
Right.
And so you have to find, there's place for the kidney. You have to figure out how you're going to use it, the liver, the tongue, everything. And then, of course, when you're talking about sustainability, which is part of the local food movement, we're not just talking about sustaining the land, we're talking about sustaining the people on the land. And so it's really important, if your farmer is using cover crop, to use the cover crop as well. So if it's rye, you want to use the rye.
Why don't you explain what a cover crop is and how it's used?
Right. Well, when a farmer's rotating his or her fields, if they have something that is drawing a lot of nutrient from the soil, they want to follow with something that replenishes the soil. So that's all about sustaining the land while you're sustaining the farmer. So you're buying that cover crop. So we use lentils. We use lots of different grains that might normally not be seen. And that's extremely important. If we're going to sustain the farmer, we have to make sure that there's some place for all of the crops to go.
But you started working in this idea of farm to table long before a lot of other people did.
It's pretty much the way I always cooked, yes.
Yeah, and I guess my question is, how do you make this pay?
Very meagerly. it can be a challenge. And then, of course, I can probably buy sustainably raised product, like particularly meat, that would fit all the parameters except for it being local. So, for instance, if I want to buy lamb, I could probably buy it from New Zealand more cheaply than I can buy it from a local farmer who's very small production and does not have government support for pricing. But I think that what's important for us is keeping as much of the money in the local economy as possible and helping our small farmers prosper. I think that back when we opened Heartland 14 years ago, paying living wage, paying fair trade, buying from farmers who practice humane and sustainable agriculture were considered relatively revolutionary concepts. Mm-hmm. Today, if you're not doing that, at least to some extent, you're not even in the game.
If someone came to you today, if I were, a young chef and I said, I want to do what you're doing, what would you say? How would you tell them to begin?
Okay. Lock yourself in a closet until you change your mind. I think it's really important to educate yourself and certainly to get out to the farm and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's really an integral piece of what we do, is understanding the farmer, what they do, what they go through, so that you can be a better partner.
Yeah.
So that, I think, would be the first step. The second step would be, you know, embed yourself in a place that you respect and learn. So mm-hmm. if you need to learn butchery from head to tail, well, you know, ask a chef who does that if you can spend some time in the kitchen. You know, the other thing I would encourage people to do is try and think outside of the box when it comes to creating the food that you want to eat and that you want others to eat. So the combinations might be different. You know, what do I do with in the middle of winter when I'm faced with eight different types of root vegetables and not much else? And so rethink how you would use those vegetables.
Yeah. Okay. But with all these ideas, mm-hmm. with all of these great beliefs and mm-hmm. whatever, do you ever want to just throw up your hands and call the Sysco truck?
No.
No?
No, never once have I ever wanted to do that. No. No, as a matter of fact, I don't have a broadliner at all, even for supplies for the bar.
A broadliner, what is that?
A broadliner is a purveyor that has a broad line of products. So, so everything from produce to, you know, pre-made frozen stuff mm-hmm. in a box.
Mm-hmm.
So typically a restaurant would employ a broadliner to supply things that maybe your bar needs, like, you know, different juices and mixers things like that. So it takes a concerted effort. It takes a lot of hard work. It's not that easy.
Do the customers tell the difference?
I believe so. I think that they appreciate the freshness of the product. I think they understand the creativity that's behind it.
Uh-huh. Lenny, thanks for talking with us.
I couldn't be happier to be here.
Nor could I in having you.
Thank you so much, Lenny.
Lenny Russo is author of Heartland, Farm Forward Dishes from the Great Midwest. Now, he does a green asparagus soup with celery seed, sour cream, and toasted hazelnuts that we eat as Friday night supper. Find the recipe at splendidtable.org. Oh, and be sure to keep us in your podcast queue. You'd be surprised how many people say that they take us to the gym. Now, if you don't already subscribe, head to iTunes and commit. Each week, we get hands-on cooking advice from America's Test Kitchen. Now, this time, our managing producer, Sally Swift, talks to Tucker Shaw, who heads up the Cook's Country team, about a seriously basic recipe that was launched in the old studio world of 1920s Hollywood.
Hey, Tucker, great to have you back.
It's great to be here. I have a story to tell you of old Hollywood. And it starts in the 1920s when Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks, who were the king and queen of Hollywood, just the biggest movie stars in the world, came together. They were a bit scandalous when they did find each other because each one of them was married to somebody else. And this was one of the first great marriage scandals of Hollywood, and it actually sort of proved the concept that you could get divorced in Hollywood and still have a career. But their life was extremely glamorous. They were loaded down with money, and they spent a great deal of time not just making movies, but also traveling and eating and entertaining. And they spent time in Rome in the mid-1920s and fell in love with a restaurateur in Rome called Alfredo di Lelio. And he was known in Rome for a particular dish that he really constructed out of three very, very basic ingredients: fettuccine, butter, and piles of Parmesan cheese. And, you know, according to his own legend, which may or may not be apocryphal, he'd invented this dish to feed to his wife, who'd been close to giving birth and had been having trouble keeping food down. So this was like a rich, caloric, very easy-to-eat dish. He started serving it in the restaurant, and it caught on with customers like crazy. And so, of course, Mary and Douglas fell in love with the dish when they were there. They brought it back, this dish, the idea of this dish, to Hollywood, where they were famous for their dinner parties. and we're able to reconstruct the dish to serve to really an A-list of Hollywood at that time. And, you know, Gloria Swanson and Charlie Chaplin and the biggest names, not just in Hollywood, but in the world. Presidents came to their house, mm-hmm. and Albert Einstein. But eventually, you know, this dish, this fettuccine dish, became legendary. And the recipe for that dish was published in a variety of places and began to take over. But home cooks had a very difficult time recreating it.
It's pretty simple, just those three ingredients. But those ingredients were probably hard to find then, correct?
Almost impossible unless you had fantastic Hollywood connections and tons of money. So, you know, a regular cook in any town, USA, was not able to get their hands on great Parmigiano-Reggiano or really beautiful European-style butter.
So I expect that recipe went south, and I bet we know it today as fettuccine Alfredo. Is that right?
That's exactly right. The thing is, when you have a very small list of ingredients, and I really am talking about three ingredients in this case, the pressure on each one of those ingredients is vastly increased. They cannot hide. Now, if you were to take a bowl of noodles and simply toss in some butter and some cheese, it'll be delicious. But it's not going to be that beautiful, cohesive sauce. So instead of adding something to that sauce, which was our first impulse, we decided to really take a step back and look at the technique and see if we could achieve what we wanted to achieve just using basically muscle and time, and we figured it out.
So it's an assembly issue.
Exactly.
Okay, so what's the secret?
So normally when we call to cook pasta, we say boil it in, you know, 4 quarts or more of salted water, and this will cook your pasta to al dente and keep it moving and keep it from sticking and so forth. But for this recipe, because we were eventually going to use some of that starchy water to help build our sauce, we needed to be very strict about the amount of water that we used. Now, adding starchy water to a pasta sauce is not really, you know, a very special idea. People do it all the time because it helps the sauce sort of adhere to the pasta. But in this case, we needed extra starch in that water. So we say, be very strict about the amount of water that you use, just 3 quarts for a pound of pasta. This will give you pasta water once the noodles have cooked that has just the right amount of starch that you need to finish off this dish.
It's going to be murky, that amount of water.
It's going to be murky and ugly and unappealing, but trust me, it will make the difference. So you cooked your noodles, you reserve 1 cup of this super starchy water, set it aside. Drain the noodles, return them to the pot. Add 2 cups, which is a lot of Parmesan cheese, but go for it. I mean, that's all you've got in this thing, so you might as well just go for it.
That is the sauce.
That is the sauce, and you've got to get the real stuff. I'm talking about Parmigiano Reggiano, which really comes from Italy. It must be imported. If you use a domestic cheese, it just won't work quite the same. You've got the noodles in there. You dump in 2 cups of grated Parm, 5 tablespoons of butter that you've cut up into little pieces, and that cup of pasta water, and you start to toss, and you toss vigorously for 1 minute. And I mean, you really have to go for it. Like, get it moving, stretch out beforehand, whatever you need to do to not stop tossing. After this 1 minute, you will think again that all is lost, because it will look like just a total hot mess. Here's what you do. You put the top on the pot and you walk away. And you must walk away. You cannot. Do not be tempted to go back into that
pot. Don't look back.
Yes. And sometimes this is the hardest thing about cooking, is to know when to leave something alone.
Yeah.
So walk away for exactly 1 minute again. Do whatever you need to do to distract yourself. Do a couple of planks or something. I don't know. And then you come back to the pot, take off the top, toss it for just 30 seconds, and you will have revealed to you a gorgeous, gorgeous, velvety cheese and butter sauce that is so much better than anything you've had that has been called Alfredo before.
What a fun thing to do at a dinner party. How dramatic.
Totally.
It sounds great. Thanks so much, Tucker.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw is executive editor of Cook's Country. Now you can find their perfect version of fettuccine with butter and cheese at splendidtable.org. We've got a lot going on there, by the way, including a video series with the new Splendid Table host, Francis Lam. He takes on some basics. This week, it is the art of the julienne, and Francis pits France versus China. Who will win? Well, head to the site and take a look. And if you want to put your knife skills to good use, check out our recipe for carrot Napa cabbage kimchi. It's all there on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a culinary love letter from the Basque Country and a comprehensive guide to a whole new group of milks. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Splendid Table is brought to you by All the Chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb Bach at locallylaid.com.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. In recent years, the Basque cities of San Sebastian and Bilbao have attracted chefs and food tourists hungry to experience the cooking of the Spanish avant-garde. But like every great cuisine that sprouts food temples, Basque cooking has a fascinating and more humble backstory. Basque cooks are famous for feasting, for whipping up grand meals in times of deprivation, and simple pitch-perfect feasts to celebrate seasonal harvests. They're known for their devotion to the most basic ingredients and their borderline obsessive attention to detail. So when the New York chef Alex Rye married Eder Montero, a Basque chef, she embarked on a lifetime's mission to cook her way through every secret in the Basque kitchen. She and Eder now have four New York City restaurants and a new cookbook, The Basque Book. Contributor Amy Thielen talked with Alex Rye about what drives this food.
Alex, it's so nice talking to you. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Alex, when I think about Basque food, I think of these Basque materia prima, the prime materials, and I'm thinking about cod and red peppers and onions and garlic, jamón serrano, that famous oily prosciutto-like ham. Can you tell me what are the materials that make up Basque food and what does it mean to you?
Well, I think they're fairly simple, and what it means to me is more that the ingredients are a direct reflection of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the foods are highly recognizable, and then when you turn them into a dish, they still reflect the landscape. So when I think about what are the hallmarks of Basque cuisine or what is it composed of, it is vegetables, lots of different kinds of lettuces, but green on green is fairly common. And it's the colors of the Ecuadena, the Basque flag, which are sort of red, green, and white. So you end up with cod.
Cod is the white part? Salt cod?
Yeah, exactly. Salt cod and salt in general. And then any sort of white flesh fish. You think about peppers, both dried and fresh. Onions. And their onions often will have these sort of green tops. They're like what they call cebolleta, more like a spring onion, but also more like Vidalia, like a big onion ball, but then with the green tops on the top. Lots of leek, cabbage, beans. I think about foods that are grown in the moment and then made to last. So drying out beans, drying out peppers, canning tuna, preserved foods.
Tell me more about how Basque cuisine deals with the red pepper haul. I feel like red peppers and those nice, oily, rusty red sauces are a hallmark of it. How do Basque cooks preserve their peppers?
Well, I mean, there's a number of different kinds of pepper, and each pepper has its own application. I think that's one thing that is very typical of Basque cuisine is that it's very specific. Like, you don't treat all peppers in the same way. So, like, they have these beautiful, sweet peppers that have like a really pliable flesh that roast beautifully. They're called piquillo peppers, and they're great for stuffing or cutting in thin ribbons and mixing into food or pureeing and making into more vinaigrettes. And those are almost rarely eaten fresh. Like, it's a thing that you actually would buy jarred or canned, or even your grandmother would can and jar a bunch, and then you would pull them out as needed.
Okay.
And then there are peppers that are ideal for drying, and those are like the choricero peppers And they're called choricero peppers because they were used to make chorizo.
Oh, interesting.
And they sort of braid them up like, you know, people make garlic braids or hang up onion or anything that they want to be a storage vegetable. But in this mm-hmm. case, they're sort of turned into these like long, almost like skeins of peppers. And they hang them outside their houses, like from their windows. And that's where they dry them out so that they have proper ventilation. So this is like very typical part of the landscape that you see is like these homes with these peppers hanging off of them. And they're sort of very postcard pretty, but they do have a purpose. And they have a purpose in every house because that's the thing in the Basque Country. Everybody sort of cooks similarly. And the personal side of it is there's these very subtle like details or tweaks that would belong to your like mother, your grandmother, your aunt's way of doing things. But fundamentally, people eat the same from home to home and restaurant to restaurant and from home to restaurant even.
I love that simplicity. It's so different from American food where, you know, really the sky's the limit. Basque food seems very codified to me. It's like loyal to the season, but also to all these traditions. So how does your creativity operate in that structure? I mean, do you find that you like to work inside those limits or do you just not follow them at all?
Oh, I do. I have such, I mean, I have too high a regard for Basque food to like take too many liberties. I want it to be recognized as Basque food, especially because I'm not cooking in the Basque Country. I mean, we've had the privilege of always sort of cooking on our own terms. But having said that, we define our style very, very narrowly, much more narrowly than might be satisfying to another kind of cook. But I just am infinitely inspired by Basque cooking and Basque ingredients and the Basque landscape. And I don't find it, even though it's narrow, I don't find it limiting at all. In fact, I find it kind of more freeing. Like I don't,
right.
I feel like that there's a logic that just like not arbitrary at all. And I think that brings a lot of elegance and grace to our cooking.
That reminds me of a sauce I really want to hear more about, salsa bizcaína, and that's one of those red pepper-based sauces, right?
Yeah, I'm actually glad you asked about that sauce because the Basque Country is composed of all these like little provinces and towns, and Biscaya is where my husband's from, so he feels super strongly about that particular sauce.
It looks so good, and I love how you describe it as doped up with bacon and chorizo. That's
great. I mean, I'm always looking for, like, equivalents for people. So for me, that sauce is, like, the Basque version of a la matriciana sauce. So if that's, like, a pasta sauce that you like, mm-hmm. you would love this. You would love this dish. It's good. It has good textures. It's got this, like, deep, rich, like, kind of sunburn flavor to it. And it's also just incredibly unique. Like, it's – I mean, I've never had – I mean, I have to draw comparisons to other things, and yet I've never had anything like that sauce anywhere else. It's just very mellow and balanced. And we make like a snail stew. Like we buy Burgundian escargot. We chop up pieces of chorizo and ham and bacon and bay leaf, and then we braise them in that sauce.
Oh, that sounds so good.
It's really good.
So how does cooking Basque food filter down to the way that you live your daily life?
I mean, the thing about Basque cooking is that everybody in the Basque Country and everybody in my house, like all my life, cooks. It's not something that like you choose to do. You do it because that it's like part of who you are. And people might do it with more or less pleasure, but they never do it halfway. Like there's not a loveless meal in the Basque Country.
That's beautiful. Alex, I love talking to you about cooking. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love talking to you and me.
Alex Rye and her husband, Edgar Montero, run 4 restaurants in New York City and are authors of The Basque Book. Amy Thielen is a James Beard Award-winning food writer and author of The New Midwestern Table. Now, for more information about Alex's book and to try out her recipes for garlic soup with torn salt cod and garden snails, yes, snails, they are very good, with bizcaína sauce, head to the website splendidtable.org. Milk not from anything with 4 legs is becoming more and more popular. By now, soy and almond milks are mainstays. Coming in strong are milks from seeds, beans, and other grains, and nuts. Think coconut milk. These milks don't just open up new drinking possibilities. They're taking beautifully to cooking and baking. Dina Cheney, in her latest book, The New Milks, explains how to make all kinds of vegan milks. Dina met up with Noelle Carter, our contributor from the LA Times.
Dina, it's such a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thanks for having me.
You know, when you think non-dairy milks, many of us think of almond or other nut-based milks, but there are so many other vegan alternatives.
That's right.
Could you tell me a little about the various options available and the differences between each?
Absolutely. The main types are coconut, legume, primarily soy, nut, seed, grain, and even tuber. So they're all different kinds. And yeah, it's kind of out there. And just to kind of go over them briefly, coconut milk many people are familiar with, but when you make it yourself, it's a real revelation. It's rich and thick and creamy, just tastes amazing, very versatile, and also really good for, you know, dessert recipes like vegan ice cream. Then you have tuber milks like tiger nut, which is just naturally really sweet, creamy, also a little high in fat and wonderful. The legume milks, especially soy milk, the most common one, they're very high in protein and calcium, and they're very versatile. They're really the most similar to cow's milk. Then you have the nut milks, and everyone knows almond milk, but you can also make pecan milk, pistachio, macadamia nut milk. So they really vary. They all tend to taste great and be very, very low in sugar. They're very, very good for you. The seed milks are rich in omega-3 and omega-6, fatty acids. And they're also really good for people with allergies. And then we have the grain milks, which I might not have covered before. And the grain milks, most people are familiar with rice milk, which has been popular in this country since the 70s. But why stop with rice? You can make millet milk, barley milk, kamut milk, oat milk. And the grain milks tend to taste really good, and also many of them are good for people with allergies as well.
You know, it sounds like the options are almost endless.
They really are. Absolutely.
What's the difference between, say, commercial milks and homemade non-dairy milks?
Okay, so that's a great question, and I want to just put out there that I make my own milks a couple times a week, but I also buy them, so I'm an advocate of both homemade and purchased. The really big difference is that when you make your own milks, you have complete control over exactly what's in the milk. For instance, you know, so when I make my own milks, I really just put the solid ingredient like almonds or coconut and water. I don't add anything else. So I have total control. You know, I know it's organic. There's no sweetener in it. There's no, you know, stabilizers. That's really the main thing. You can control the content, the consistency. You can also make some kind of wacky varieties that you can't find in stores. The store-bought milks, usually they have additives, stabilizers, you know, different ingredients like gums and lecithin and carrageenan in some cases, which really kind of emulsify the milks so that the ingredients don't separate. You don't have to shake the milk. When you make homemade milks, you really need to shake them before you use them. So that's the main difference. And also, when I make them at home, I tend to use a higher ratio of the solid ingredient to water. So if I'm making almond milk, I'll usually use a cup of almonds and 3 cups of water. With the packaged milks, they use a much higher ratio of water to solid. So there aren't generally as many nutrients. That said, many of the packaged products are fortified to make up for that difference.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
I know. It's a lot of information.
Let's say I want to make my own milks. Are they hard to make? Do I need any special equipment or anything?
So they're really, really easy to make. I mean, especially the nut, seed, and tuber milks. Let's say it's almond milk. You soak the almonds in water overnight. The next morning, you just rinse and drain. Takes 2 seconds. Throw them in a blender with some fresh water. Blend for about a minute and then strain. Voila, you have almond milk. It takes literally 5 minutes of active time to make almond milk. It's good to soak overnight, so you have to, you know, plan in advance, but it's so easy. Now, homemade coconut milk is a little more involved, but you don't need to soak. So you can have homemade coconut milk within a half hour of active time. The tuber milk is the same as a nut milk. You soak overnight for, you know, tiger nut milk, and it's the same process. Soy milk and grain milk, you do need to soak overnight, and then you need to cook the grains or the legumes before you blend with water and strain. So the grain milks and the legume milks take slightly more time. But that said, I mean, they're really all very easy to make and very basic in terms of the equipment that you need.
And you can use these solids after you strain them. It's not like you're wasting the nuts. I mean, you can use the grains and everything for other purposes.
Absolutely. I mean, I never throw away the solids. I usually do strain my milks because I like to have the consistency be, you know, similar to store-bought milk, right? But I pretty much always keep my solids. I will either keep them wet after straining, just add them to smoothies or to oatmeal, pancake batter, quick bread batter, or all you do is pour them onto a parchment-lined baking sheet in a, you know, low oven, like 250 degrees, and bake for about 2 hours so that the mixture dries out, and then run it through a food processor, pulse it, and then basically you have homemade almond flour, hemp seed flour. And this stuff is expensive. If you want to buy, you know, almond flour at the store, I mean, some of these flours, it can be like $13 for one small package. So you really do. And then you get the fiber, right? You're getting all the nutrients from the solid ingredients.
Yeah. Now, if I'm baking or cooking, do I have to worry about, you know, say if a recipe calls for milk, do I have to worry about what sort of non-dairy alternative I use? Is there any sort of guideline that I should keep in mind for substitutions?
Basically, you can use plant-based milks and dairy milk interchangeably. You absolutely can. The only things I would say is that like rice milk is pretty thin, right? So you want to think about consistency. Like, let's say you're making crepes. Rice milk would be great because, you know, crepe batter is thin. But if you need a thicker milk, you might want to go for coconut milk, right? If you're making with cooking, if you want to make a cream sauce, I wouldn't use oat milk or rice milk because they're thinner and oat milk is sweet. I would use cashew milk because cashew milk is creamy and rich and neutral in flavor. So, yeah, you want to make sure you match the consistency and the flavor of the plant-based milk with your recipe.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Dina, this is such a great book. I can't wait to try these recipes. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great talking to you.
Dina Cheney is author of The New Milks. Our contributor, Noel Carter, is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Now, Dina wants us to try two of her recipes, coffee almond pudding and vegan Provençal quiche. You can find them both at splendidtable.org. Coming up, I'll answer your culinary questions and the story of a rather unusual vending machine in Paris. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
The number you have reached has been disconnected.
It is time to turn to your calls. Now, it's no secret this is my favorite part of the show. I love connecting with you. So get in touch, 800-537-5252, so we can talk. Allie's calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. Allie, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me. I am calling because last winter, my husband and I made homemade limoncello, and we wanted to give it to our family and friends for gifts. And, you know, we made a big vat of this limoncello.
Right.
And put it in little jars to give away. And we thankfully had enough left over that we have had it at our house ever since. And we love having it around, break it out, whether we have guests or if it's just us. And we'd love to make this a tradition. We'd love to always just have homemade limoncello around.
Right, right.
But when we made it, we used the peels of 30 lemons. And then
yeah, a little bit of work there. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it took a while. But then we really didn't know what to do with 30 unpeeled lemons. I think we put it in our water for a couple days. I think my husband stuffed it in a chicken one night, but a lot of the lemons went to waste. And, you know, if we continue to do this, which we would love to, I'd love your advice on what we can do with a large quantity of peeled lemons.
Okay. First of all, one thing you can do is to freeze them.
Okay.
Take heavy-duty freezer bags.
Okay.
Stuff the lemons in it. And I would squish them down so that when you seal that bag, you have about a quarter to a half inch of lemon pulp. So whenever you want fresh lemon, open a bag and you just break it off. Now, you'll have some pits and you'll have, you know, some pulp. But really, You could strain it once it liquefies, but you can use that in 100 ways. I mean, you could work some of that into a pan sauce. You can make lemon drinks out of that, lemon curd. You know, just a bit of butter, a bit of lemon, and finish it off with whipped cream, and you fold that in, and it is the most fabulous dessert you've ever eaten in your life.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah. So don't waste it the next time.
Okay.
And great. I love the idea of the limoncello being a family tradition, being something you always have. It's a great way to entertain people and greet them, don't you think? Or finish
a
meal.
I think so, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to keep doing it.
Hey, Allie, enjoy.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Max has sent us a note asking about balsamic vinegar just down my alley. It seems that his wife is from Tuscany, and she brought back some fabulous, thick, lovely aged balsamic vinegar from some folks on a farm that she knows there. And Max says they cherished it a bit too much, because now about a third of it has essentially dried up at the bottom of the bottle, and he wants to know what to do with it. Well, this, I've had the same thing happen. What's happened to that balsamic vinegar is that the moisture is evaporated. So what you do is you add a little bit of water, just a bit. Bring it back to kind of where it was. So if it looks like you've got 2 tablespoons of this rich, thick balsamic vinegar that's now a solid mass, I'd add a teaspoon, maybe 2 teaspoons of water. And then what I do is put the bottle in a bowl of hot water. You want to warm it very gently to soften up what's going on in the bottom of the bottle, and then take the handle of a spoon, something narrow you can get down the neck of the bottle, and give it a bit of a stir. And you'll see it'll all come together, and you'll have that thick syrup back again. Now, the other thing, Max put an addendum on the note and saying that what he did was he added port wine to it, and he shook it up. There's nothing wrong with that. It's going to change the taste a bit, but good port wine's fabulous. And I have to say, sometimes balsamic reminds me of port wine. So use it as you would use the balsamic. But it's a good trick. If you've got some great balsamic and it's dried up, just essentially rehydrate it. And another great question. Thanks, Max. 800-537-5252. Patrick, you're calling us from Phillipsburg, New Jersey. Where is Phillipsburg?
Well, if you know anything about the Delaware River.
Oh, yeah. The west side of the state.
It bisects Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And I'm calling you up the river, and it's nothing like people think about New Jersey. It's a pretty nice place, to be honest with you.
I think I know that country. It's all mountains and gorgeousness, if I remember.
Not all gorgeousness, but yes, most of it. And I'm going to go on a backpacking trip along the John Muir Trail. And here are my tools, and I need your help on the food part.
Okay.
I got a dehydrator and a vacuum sealer. And I'm sure you're familiar with both implements.
Right.
And so far, I've made only fruit roll-ups and enough spaghetti with meat sauce to, you know, gag an army. And what I'd like to know, if you have any tips on what I can make that can use those tools, because it reduces the weight, obviously.
Obviously it does, but I'm a little worried about something. Oh. If you're doing spaghetti with meat sauce, is it going to be...
It's been vacuumed.
Right, but is it going to be refrigerated?
Well, it's in my freezer right now, but here's the deal. With a dehydrator, you take out all the moisture, and what you do is it takes about 20 hours sometimes.
Right.
To do it. And then you get it out, and it's kind of, flaky in a way. And then you just take it and put it in this vacuum sealer, which sucks out all the oxygen. And just that's it.
I Patrick, unless you're getting every single bit of moisture out of something like spaghetti with tomato sauce or meat sauce,
right?
I would be really, really, really nervous. Seriously.
Oh,
I mean,
really
because, and by the way, when you're talking botulism, which is one of the main things that can happen in a situation like this,
sure.
You can't smell it, you can't taste it, and you can't cook it away.
You sure feel it after a while, though, I take it, right?
If you live.
I don't mean to be melodramatic, but I mean, this is the kind of thing that kills people.
And, all right, well, I
think what you want to do is, if you're going to dehydrate, think in terms of dehydrating things that are easy to really remove all of the moisture from. So things like dried beans. Sure. Or and dried beans, yes, you're going to have to cook them. But if you've chipped them, you know, if you've broken them down and and then added dried vegetables to that mix and other things and seasonings, first of all, you're going to get a heck of a lot of good, solid, complex carbs that give you a great deal of energy, not sugared things
That was my next question.
Yeah.
Like, I need something to give me some pep.
Exactly, exactly. And I would look at the dried meats, by the way. I would look at things like the jerkies or things that are traditionally dried.
Well, I can make them in this dehydrator. But
yeah, you can. But you remember, small, small, thin, thin pieces. So they're dried to the point that they're like cardboard.
Yeah, and right.
Yeah, exactly. That's the basic concept.
I've done onions, garlic, tomatoes, and that's as far as I've gotten. But I got till the end of June to figure all this stuff out.
Well, you can think of dried spices, because they can be really dynamite. You've got basil, you know, you've got every herb you can imagine, and then you've got all kinds of things like allspice and cinnamon and black pepper with a little bit of coriander seed, okay? You can grind that up yourself, or you can buy them and mix them up. If you put those in a few packets, you know, make a couple of packets of that, that's a seasoning mix you can use anywhere you want to.
Okay.
And then you can do the Italian one with the dried lemon peel, okay, and the dried garlic and the basil and the parsley. And those can be little packs, you know, that you can tuck anywhere in your knapsack.
Yeah.
And that will give you a lot of sparkle. Now, one of the fun things is you can take some ground chili and you can mix that up with dried ginger. And you can do, again, the black pepper and a little bit of sugar.
Yeah, but what am I cooking, though?
Well, what you're cooking is...
spices are great, but
yeah, I understand.
I got to carry the food.
You're going to look at the dried meats. You're going to look at the dried beans that you're going to break up, right?
Right.
And you can do dried vegetables.
Yeah, I got those.
Yeah. And if you look at recipes, you can start to break them down. You can say, oh, wait a minute. If I've got dried beef here, and then I've got some dried tomato, and then I've got some of the spices, and I have water, I can do a stew with dried vegetables in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to admit that my idea of roughing it is maybe the Peninsula Hotel with room service. So, hey, Patrick, thank you. And I'm sorry I couldn't help you more.
Okay, thanks, Lynn. Bye.
Bye. 800-537-5252. That's how you can call us. We've got a question from Marjorie about steak knives. She says, which steak knives do you recommend, serrated or not? And do I have any brand ideas? First of all, I don't like serrated knives for steak. They tear the meat. And I don't know. I don't want my meat torn. I want a really sharp knife. There are a couple of brands. Victorinox is one that you can find on a lot of sites. This is a very reasonably priced line of very good quality knives. And I haven't actually used their steak knives, but I use their other knives, and I have no doubt their steak knives are going to be just dynamite. Now, if you want to invest a little bit more money, Henkel. It's a German brand. It is a really good, reliable old-timer. They make excellent knives. And then you may be able to find some Japanese-style steak knives. And these are blades, and this is a kind of knife that's made in a slightly different way than Western knives. And these will generally cut beautifully. They need a little bit more fussing. You sharpen them in a slightly different way than you sharpen Western knives. Usually Western knives, you want a 20-degree angle, you know, when you run that knife over a rod or a steel. But with Japanese knives, this is picky, you want a 17-degree angle because the blades are set just a little bit differently. Anyway, no serrated steak knives for me. And look at Victorinox for a really reasonably priced, very good quality knife, steak or otherwise. And thanks for a great question, Marjorie. You know how to reach us, 800-537-5252. Run your credit card through your local vending machine, and you can get lunch, snacks, drinks, even hot soup. But the French have done us one better. Slip your card and pick up your steak for a midnight supper, or your burger, or your sausage. Our contributor David Leet was intrigued by this idea, so he tracked down journalist Samuel Petriquin in Paris.
Samuel, welcome all the way from France to the show.
Good afternoon.
So tell me about this very curious contraption, which to us Americans seems rather odd, of a meat vending machine in Paris.
Yeah, I have to tell you that for us French, it's very odd too, because this is not something we often see in the Paris streets. Mm-hmm. There are three of these machines in France, and okay. The one in Paris is outside a butcher shop. So I went to see the owners of the butcher shop, and surprising me, they told me that their business started very well, actually. After a couple of months of activity, they are selling a lot of meat from the machine. And I spoke to some of the people in the butcher shop, and they were quite interested in the concept. Most of them saying that that would help them during weekends when lots of shops are closed in France, especially the little ones, the little shops. And they said that it would be very convenient to have such a machine. And also the owners of the butcher shop said that many customers buying the meat from the machine are actually revelers after a night out in Paris. 2 o'clock in the morning, they're getting hungry, they buy a steak, they go back home, they cook the steak, open another bottle of wine, and the party continues.
That is fantastic. That idea is fantastic. I was just kind of imagining these older cooks, these women and these men going there and not being able to sort of tell the butcher, I want that particular meat, I want that particular steak. So they were okay with whatever comes out of the vending machine, right?
Yeah, you're right. Some of the other people I spoke with, they said that they like to come to their favorite shop to speak with a butcher, have some sort of interaction between them. And they were less interested in the concept. They want to have the possibility to choose. But I have to say, I tested a very nice pâté. The quality of the food is amazing. You know, it's a refrigerated machine. They're changing the meat every day. And, the pâté I had I was excellent. I had it with a baguette, and it was perfect sandwich. And the price is quite the same as the products they sell inside the shop.
Speaking of baguettes, there are also machines that sell baguettes, which were the precursor to the meat machines, correct?
Exactly. The baguette vending machine was the precursor, and it has spread across France very quickly. They became very popular, actually.
And what are some of the meats that are being sold in the vending machines? There's steak, you said. What else?
So you've got steak, you've got pâté, you've got beef carpaccio, a lot of delicatessen coming from the southwest of France, because the owners are from that region.
Any sausage?
Sausages as well, yeah.
Now, do you see this concept taking off in Paris?
Difficult to say. I'm quite skeptical, actually. It's a good extra something, you know, like we said before, for revelers, for people going out late.
Right.
But it won't take over. You know, it's like Paris, contrary to London, for example, is a city where small shops are still predominant. People in Paris don't really like to go to supermarkets, so I guess they will remain attached to their local shops and won't switch to machines for that.
Samuel, thank you for coming on the show. It was a pleasure.
Thanks very much for having me.
Reporter Samuel Petriquin lives and writes in Paris. David Leet's new book is Notes on a Banana, a Memoir of Food, Love, and Manic Depression. Well, that's the show for this week. Francis Lam will be here next week, so don't miss it. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Anonymous. Change is inevitable, except from a vending machine. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, if you want to track down more information on anything you heard here today, head to splendidtable.org. You can register for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, check out our monthly giveaways, find the perfect recipe for your weekend dinner parties, and if you want to hear more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Hey, thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.